The ideal subject of totalitarian rule is not the convinced Nazi or the convinced communist, but people for whom the distinction between fact and fiction, true and false, no longer exist.
Hello, and welcome to the 41st episode of Neohuman Podcast. I'm Agha Bahari at Agologist on Twitter and Instagram, and you can follow the show on liveinlimbo.com, iTunes, and YouTube. And today with me, I have Lee McIntyre. Welcome to the show, Lee.
Thank you. Thanks very much. It's a pleasure.
It's my pleasure as well. Why don't we start with your background, some of the work you've worked on, and some of the areas and what you're mainly focusing on now these days.
Okay, so I'm a philosopher. I'm trained in the philosophy of science and epistemology, and I've done academic work in those areas for quite a number of years. Many years back, about 15 years ago, I decided that I wanted to start working on philosophical topics that had some resonance with a general audience. I wanted to apply philosophy to a wider set of problems than philosophers tend to focus on. And so I wrote a book called Dark Ages, where I explored the idea that we were in the dark ages of the social sciences, dark ages of understanding human behavior, because we needed to emulate the methodology in the natural sciences.
You mean now we are in the dark ages of social...
Correct, right. That if you look back in history, you look at the first dark ages, the dark ages in the 1,000-year span back in human history, they proceeded on the basis of superstition and ignorance, didn't understand quite a bit about the world, the natural world. But the thing is that nobody who's living in the dark ages sees themselves as living in the dark ages. They think they're in the most enlightened age that's ever been. Mm-hmm. So my concept was, we could be living in a dark age right now and not understand it. We could think that we were enlightened, that we understood all the important facts about human behavior, but we really didn't. And so my idea was, the natural sciences have been very successful. The social sciences have not been very successful. What's the difference? The difference is the methodology that they use in the natural sciences. And so that book was about emulating that methodology and doing a better job of understanding human behavior by being more rigorous in our thinking about why it is that we behave the way that we behave. So that was my first foray into this. And then the world changed. What happened next is I had held up the natural sciences as this pinnacle of success. Meanwhile, there were all sorts of attacks on the natural sciences. There have always been people, I guess, who didn't accept the idea of evolution by natural selection. But then that morphed into climate change denial. And so I started to wonder, how is it that natural science works as well as it does, but people are not willing to accept evidence when it's right in front of their face, when it's gone through the process of science, which is maybe the most rigorous process that one can imagine for discovering truth, and people are still rejecting it. And that question led me to my next book, which is called Respecting Truth. And I wanted to take the problem that I had started with in Dark Ages out a little bit, one ring further, and start to ask the question of, what is it that leads us to reject things when we think that we already know them or when we haven't even investigated them properly. The conclusion I started to come to is that it really had nothing to do with methodology. It had to do with attitude. It had to do with people's psychological orientation toward hearing truths that they didn't want to accept. And so I started to think much more about that. So Respecting Truth was about science denial. And then the world changed again. So Respecting Truth came out in 2015. It was published before and the 2016 campaign. I don't even think Trump had announced that he was a candidate.
Next thing you know, what had happened previously in science denial was now happening with fact denial. People were feeling free, both in the campaign and after Trump won the presidency, they were feeling free to deny provable facts, things for which there was videotape, eyewitness evidence, things that it seemed ridiculous for anybody to doubt. And I started to think about why that was, and it seemed to me that it was now all the previous work made sense. It was part of an arc, which was that people, if they have the wrong attitude toward truth, if they believe in things primarily on the basis of their feelings and they don't have a critical attitude toward belief, then we end up with what I now call post-truth. We end up in a world where you can look at the photograph and see how many people were at the inauguration compared to Obama's inauguration. And there shouldn't be any dispute about it, but people get away with saying, no, the Trump inauguration was larger. We now live in a world where even though the murder rate has been going down for many decades, as measured by the FBI's Uniform Crime Report, people like Trump and Newt Gingrich and others feel free to deny that and say that, no, it's in fact going up, which is primarily based on the idea that people feel that it's going up because they feel threatened and that they can get a lot of people to agree with them. This really, as a philosopher, this really hurt me because philosophers care a lot about truth. So in my latest book, I've started to examine how we got here and where we might be headed, because to me, being in a post-truth world, I'm not really sure there's any more water to let out of the pool at this point. I think that the next step after post-truth is authoritarianism, and that's a very dangerous place to be.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's so much to talk about, but I want to start with your latest book, Post-Truth, that came out February 9th, if I'm not mistaken.
Yep.
By MIT Press, and it's part of the MIT Press Essential Knowledge series. Mm-hmm. Before talking about that, though, what is the definition of a truth?
So, that's of course a difficult question. You'll get different answers to that question from different philosophers. Philosophers have different definitions of what it means for something to be true. Probably the most famous theory is called the correspondence theory, which is the idea that if a statement can be either true or false. So if you make a statement and that statement corresponds with what you would find in reality, then that statement is true. And if it doesn't, then it's not. But there are criticisms of the correspondence theory of truth. Criticisms having to do with whether or not there are different perspectives on truth, different modes of description for one and the same truth. Just the whole idea that you can have some sort of a connection between knowing how the world is in and of itself, unmediated by language, versus assessing whether the statement that you just made is true. So there are other theories of truth, the coherence theory of truth, the pragmatic theory of truth. There's a whole branch in philosophy called epistemology, where they study the different theories of truth. I wrote Post-Truth to be philosophically adept, but not primarily for a philosophical audience. So I tried not to get too exercised about defending some particular definition of truth. I guess you could say I went more for the idea that We know what truth means. Truth is when you say something I'm going to go back to the correspondence theory. Is when it fits with reality. When you've got evidence that it's true, when it's something that you've got a reasonable, justified belief that it's true. Again, philosophers can get into many disputes over how that's assessed. And again, I didn't mean anything in particular by it other than just the idea that when we make a statement that's true, it's because we recognize it as being justifiable on what we know about reality.
Do you think right off the bat that's problematic for a general public who might have a different objective than understanding the philosophical truth when there is different interpretations for a single truth? As you said, there are different approaches to the concept of truth. Do we need some sort of a unified theory of truth? Or
well, I don't think that most people who are post-truth folks these days, you know, the folks who deny facts that they're right in front of their face, I don't think they're rejecting people who reject climate change. I don't think they reject it on philosophical grounds. I don't think they reject it because they don't like the theory of truth that scientists are using. I think that they reject it because it doesn't fit with what they want to believe. So one really important thing in philosophy that has to do with the concept of truth is the idea of warrant, that you're entitled to believe something as being true if that's a warranted belief, if you're justified based on the evidence or based on argument to believe that it's true. I think the key to understanding why people push back on things that are obviously true is because they don't perhaps accept the idea of warrant or reason or even evidence for their beliefs. There are, you know, 30 years of cognitive psychology, which shows that beliefs are subject to all sorts of pressures, social pressure, cognitive bias, et cetera, which can in some cases have nothing to do with justification based on what's happening in reality. So I understand what you're saying, that, you know, people might feel like, well, I'm off the hook. If philosophers can't even agree about what the definition of truth is, then, you know, it's all just narrative and I don't have to believe anything in particular. And some people probably make that sort of sophisticated criticism. I don't think that's the bulk of it. I think that if you look at the rejection of obvious truths, the rejection that Newt Gingrich made just after the Republican National Convention of the idea that the murder rate was falling rather than rising, that was political. That was not philosophical. I mean, Newt Gingrich is a very smart guy, and maybe he's read his postmodernists, and maybe he's thought about relativism and could give that kind of a response. But he didn't say that. What he said was, well, I think that the murder rate is going up because I can find millions of people who agree with me.
And that's exactly my point, because Newt Gingrich and Donald Trump, these are individuals, right? But there are millions of people who are buying what they're saying.
That's true.
So when there is not a unified method of measurement, then Newt Gingrich can say, or whoever else can say, hey, that photo that has that was taken at Trump inauguration, it was like 4 hours before it began, which is one of the excuses that they come up with, right? Mm-hmm. And a lot of people will be like, yeah, that can be true, because their objective, their purpose...
But that can be checked.
Right, but they don't care about it because their objective is not philosophical. They have their own like politics for Newt Gingrich and Donald Trump, maybe for some regular... minor in West Virginia be just losing his job and just not looking beyond that. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, it does, because there's something in psychology called motivated reasoning, which is that we are, you know, when we want to find reason to believe something, we'll probably find it. There's a closely related, there's a cognitive bias that's gotten a lot of press lately, called confirmation bias. This is when we're more likely to believe things. We're more likely to look for evidence that confirms what we already believe, and to discount evidence that disconfirms what we already believe. If somebody's already of the mindset that they know what's true on the basis of their ideology, then they're not going to be very rigorous about justifying their belief, because to them the belief doesn't need to be justified. They already believe it. But that's not good, because to me also that strikes of a double standard. Then you have a situation where you really have no mechanism at all for knowing what's true or what's false. You know, you live in a world where you've got to find out what's best for your ideology or your party or your politics before you can say whether or not something is true. I remember not long after he was elected, Trump said that any polls which showed that he was less popular were fake polls, but any polls which showed that he was popular were good polls. I don't know how anybody can operate in that sort of a world where you've got to consult your gut, you've got to consult your feelings, find out what you hope to be true, and then that is true. I don't think that people would want a cancer doctor who operated that way. I don't think that people would want the National Transportation Safety Board to operate that way. We expect evidence for empirical claims about reality. We need to know if there's evidence that the thing that we think is true is true. It may be politically expedient in certain circumstances for people to deny that, but I think that's just it's a form of dishonesty, and you can measure the dishonesty by looking at the double standard. A good example here are conspiracy theories. People who believe in conspiracy theories sometimes mark themselves off as skeptics. You know, they're people who they just won't let somebody else pull the wool over their eyes. And yet they're completely gullible about things that they want to believe and will look for evidence. They will look for, you know, they will cite evidence if it's favorable to the conspiracy that they want to say is true, but they will, anything that runs against it, they'll say, oh, well, that hasn't been 100% proven yet. So I guess as a philosopher, my objection is that the standards of evidence don't make any sense. You know, if the standard of evidence for belief is, well, I want to believe that, so I'm going to believe it, I've got to think that eventually we pay the price for that. I've got to think that eventually, no matter how much people might deny that climate change is real, someday we're going to see that it's real. If we build prisons because we think that the murder rate's going up when it's actually going down, there are consequences to that.
One of the biggest groups who are supporting Trump, and there still are, and it's kind of mind-blowing, are evangelical Christians.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see any correlation between not only Christianity, but all religions with lack of respect for evidence in order to confirm a bias?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, in respecting truth, I wrote about the idea that both religion and political beliefs could be ideological, and that ideology was the enemy of the idea that you believe things that were true on the basis of good evidence. And I think that post-truth, as I've talked about it in the book and as it exists in today's society, is by and large a political phenomena, not a religious phenomena. But you bring up a good point, which is that quite a number of people in Trump's base are evangelical Christians. And so the question is, are they willing to compromise their standards of what they think is true in order for their political or their religious beliefs to be satisfied? I confess, I really don't know the answer to that. I don't know what the reasoning is. I'm not someone who thinks that, look, if I were a person of faith, which I'm not, but if I were a person of faith, I suppose you could make the argument that faith is a kind of evidence, that faith is something that, can't really be ignored by the person who has it. But then I think you have to question it. You have to ask, well, is that wishful thinking? Where does the faith come from? Is it based on fear of what's going to happen to me after I die, et cetera, et cetera? The problem with faith is that it's not public. It's not shareable. If you and I are having an argument over crowd size at Trump's inauguration, we could have a dispute back and forth over whether there are empty chairs in the picture, and then somebody might say, well, this one picture was taken 4 hours earlier than the other one. We could bring up relevant arguments back and forth about claims about evidence. I don't think that works that way with religious belief, because a person who has faith, that's meaningful for them, but it doesn't convince me. Religious beliefs are not ordinarily the kind of thing where people feel that they have to have evidence. I suppose faith is a sort of personal evidence, and there are some philosophical arguments where people will say, well, look how beautifully the world is designed. Doesn't that seem to suggest that God exists? So that's a sort of an appeal to evidence. But then there's counter evidence. Well, but then why is there evil in the world? Why is there human suffering? Would a perfect God allow that? So, I mean, there can be disputes along those evidential sorts of disputes for religious beliefs. My main conclusion, I think, is that religious beliefs, by and large, are not based on evidence, unless it's the personal evidence of faith. So I guess I think that maybe what's happened in contemporary society with post-truth is that the evangelical Christians, it's not that they're so enamored with Trump's religious faith or feel that his strategy is upholding their values, as I think that they're seeing sort of a parallel between some of the things that they value based on their faith-based beliefs and some of the political platforms that are supported by the Republican Party. So there can be a kind of a marriage between those two, so that they happen to be in favor of the political view. But I'm really not sure I'm comfortable with the idea that it's the religious faith that's motivating post-truth. I mean, look, it can be. In Dark Ages, I talked about Galileo. His main opponents were in the Catholic Church. They did not want to believe that the things that he was seeing through his telescope were real, because their faith told them that they were not real. In that book, I argued that political ideology was today doing to social science what religious ideology had done in Galileo's day to natural science. I'm not sure I completely believe that anymore, to the extent that I think that political ideology is today also an enemy of the natural sciences. So it's expanded.
Mm-hmm.
Hope I answered your question. That's a really good, tough question, and I hope I made some progress on it, even if I didn't completely answer it.
Oh, absolutely. I never thought of this post-truth world as being caused by only one element. You know, there are so many different things.
You're right.
I see it.
Yeah.
I'm going to read a paragraph that you wrote on your website, and then we delve right into post-truth.
Sure.
You say, "Are we living in a post-truth world where alternative facts replace actual facts and feelings have more weight than evidence? In my last book, Post-Truth, I traced the development of this phenomenon from its root in science denial, cognitive bias, and postmodernism through the rise of fake news, information silos, and alternative media. What exactly is post-truth?" So what exactly is post-truth? And we already talked about where it all began. So what is the definition of post-truth as you see it?
I didn't make up the concept of post-truth, the word, the definition. In the Essential Knowledge series, I'm supposed to, which is my book is in the Essential Knowledge series at MIT Press. Our charge is to take an idea that's out there in the zeitgeist and to gather information from a number of sources and talk about how what the idea is. And post-truth was the Oxford Dictionary's 2016 word of the year. And they defined it as a situation where feelings had more weight than evidence in deciding whether something was true or not. That I think, is a pretty good definition of post-truth. That's still a little wooden to put it that way, because then you need some examples to make it clear, you know, how that actually works in the real world. But I think it's the best sort of definition that I could give you of what post-truth is it's this idea that we've gone beyond saying that we believe something is true or false based simply on the evidence for it. Instead, we are in an era where it matters how we feel about it and whether other people agree with us. And that's post-truth in many ways, because it's not respecting the classical definitions of truth that philosophers and others I think would give. And I can give you some examples of it, of post-truth, because I think that one of the best ways to understand what post-truth is to see it in action. But as far as a definition is concerned, it's defined by the Oxford dictionaries as a situation where feelings have more weight than evidence.
Mm-hmm. And you see that the next step would be authoritarianism.
Yeah, that's the danger. That's the danger, I think, which is that, then this is the scary part that I probably didn't say enough about in the book. I did an op-ed that appeared in the New Statesman some months after I wrote the book, but before the book had appeared, in which I wanted to explore this question that everybody seemed to be asking in the media, which was, why would Trump lie about something where he could obviously be refuted by the facts? Why would he lie about something where they could play a videotape of him saying the exact opposite, or something where there was another kind of evidence? And the answer, I think, and again, I didn't come up with this answer, but I'm convinced that it's true based on my readings from other folks. I think that the answer is that post-truth, you know, lying when you know that you're lying, is a form of control. It's an assertion of power. Trump doesn't tell a lie about the size of his crowd at the inauguration because he expects you to believe it. He doesn't maybe even tell that lie because he thinks it's true. He tells it because it shows he's the boss. He tells it because it shows that he's in control and that he can get away with it. The Russian dissident Masha Gessen said that Trump lies to assert power, and I think that that's right. And my piece in the New Statesman was called Why Trump and Putin Lie and Why They're So Good at It. And what I'm afraid of is that post-truth is a tactic. It's easy to treat it like a sideshow, but I think that it's a tactic, that it's the first step in gaining authoritarian control. If you look back over history, you see that authoritarian regimes, autocratic regimes, often test to see how much they can get away with when they're just getting started. And one of the first things that they push back on is the idea that there's any such thing as objective truth, that there's any truth that's something that they haven't said is true. There's a terrific book called How Propaganda Works by Jason Stanley, in which he talks about the idea that the point of propaganda is not to convince you. The point of propaganda is to rule you, so that even if you live in a society where everybody knows that the propaganda posters are fake, they're false, they're saying things that aren't true, the point of them is to show you who's boss. The point is to intimidate you, to let you know that you live in a world where, even though you can see with your own eyes that something is false, you can't say it because you're being dominated. Somebody else is dominating your reality. That's George Orwell's 1984. I mean, that's the society that Hannah Arendt, totalitarian societies that Hannah Arendt talks about, where I'm quoting this from memory. She says that I'm not going to get the quotation right. I guess I could, I can look it up here. She was interested in the idea that the first step in authoritarian government was to find people for whom the difference between true and false didn't matter. That's the point.
What's really interesting to me is that even though a lot of people say Trump is far right, I don't really buy it that he's far right. I don't think he cares about anything but himself. But a lot of techniques and a lot of ideology seems to be shared between right, far right, and far left, which leads me to my next question, that how do you see the role of postmodernism in all of this, and what's happening in colleges and universities with respect to what can be discussed, shutting down speakers?
Yeah, so that's another good question, right? There are other folks, and I haven't particularly written on this, but there are other folks who've written on the idea of the free speech movements that evolved from the radical left to the radical right, and there's some interesting parallels going on there from censorship from the right and censorship from the left. I want to pick up on something that you mentioned there, which is something that I have written about in Post Truth, which was the idea that I think that one of the precursors of Post Truth is postmodernism. Now that's going to drive people on the academic left absolutely insane, because postmodernism is an idea that largely grew out of left-wing politics. It was this idea that people who made truth claims were trying to assert power, that they were, just what I was talking about before, that they were trying to dominate somebody else's reality, and that you had to take any truth claim that was made by someone with a grain of salt, and you had to examine their politics. And then that, I think, in some cases morphs over into the belief that there is no such thing as truth, that all truth is perspectival, it's relative, and that the only thing that we really have is narrative, that we don't really have any way to verify whether something is true or not. So, if you look at the history of postmodernism, which is also a movement in art and architecture and such, but if you look at the postmodernist movement for the last 30 years, one of the things that happened is that they attacked science. They attacked the idea that natural science was actually discovering truth. And this led to a huge uproar with the natural scientists, as the folks in critical theory and such were doubling down on the idea that, there was no such thing as truth, and that in fact natural scientists were almost a sort of fascist for getting in there and saying that certain things were true and other things were not true. Well, then a very interesting thing happened. That vocabulary, that attitude, that openness to questioning whether or not there was, you should believe that something was true, even if scientists had evidence for it, started to be picked up by the right wing. And this is still somewhat controversial, but I do have a chapter on it in my book, where I think a lot of people want to deny the idea that postmodernism had anything to do with post-truth, but I don't think it's deniable. I think that there were folks on the right wing who were self-consciously borrowing the vocabulary and the theory and the ideas from postmodernism to attack the idea of truth that they didn't like. I think that that's clear in the first place in science denial. There was a terrific paper by Robert Pennock where he examined some of the statements by one of the founders of intelligent design theory. And what he found is that the person who was talking about how creationism became intelligent design theory, and how this should be taught in the public schools, that it shouldn't just be evolution taught in the public schools. There was a competing narrative, which was intelligent design. He was self-consciously borrowing from the postmodernists. He had read his Derrida and his Foucault, and he self-consciously said that what he was doing was he was borrowing from the postmodernists to attack evolution. Not too many years later, I think that that's what's happening now with post-truth. In the same way that I think that science denial is a precursor to post-truth, I think that this idea of using postmodernism to attack science
first all science from the academic left, but then also specifically the idea of evolution by natural selection from, you know, folks who were more evangelical, shall we say. I think that's now morphed into this idea that all truth is up for grabs, that there is only such a thing as narrative. I think that there are right-wing postmodernists. There are some bloggers out there, some intellectuals on the right, who people are very prone to dismiss. They should not be dismissed. They're very intelligent people who have read their postmodernism. And, you know, people make fun of this idea because they say, well, you know, can you just imagine Trump or Kellyanne Conway or Sean Spicer reading postmodern literature? And no, they probably don't. But some of the building blocks, some of the intellectual hardware has been built by bloggers from the right. And it comes down as a series of talking points. And it does infect the way that people think about truth. So that, I mean, my opinion, and again, I've written about it more in the book, is that what happened is that postmodernism is a precursor, a cause of post-truth, because the right wing borrowed it from the left wing and used it for their own purposes, which was to attack and challenge the facts that they didn't like, which weren't leaving room for their competing narrative from the right.
So the authoritarianism that you mentioned as a possible next stage, would that be a right-wing authoritarianism, left-wing authoritarianism, or a post-truth combination that is a hybrid of both?
I don't know. I mean, you're absolutely right. There can be left-wing authoritarians and right-wing authoritarians. I just got done reading a terrific the new biography. Can't remember who the author was, but about Lenin. Lenin was obviously a left-wing authoritarian. I mean, he was as far left as you could get, but he was an autocrat, an authoritarian, a terrorist in the tactics that he used. And, you know, a lot of the post-truth tactics that we today think of were things that Lenin also used. I think that the danger today is from the right. And what's happened is, you know, you begin to hear rumblings about this. There's a book called On Tyranny. There's Jason Stanley's got his book, How Propaganda Works. You know, you started about 6 or 8 months ago to hear people using the word authoritarian and autocracy. It's now made its way mainstream. You're now reading editorials in the Washington Post. You're hearing it on CNN. The other day I was watching CNN and I saw David Gergen, who was a counselor to Nixon, Ford, Reagan, also Bill Clinton, who was saying that he thought that Trump's attack on the media and his failure to do anything about the growing threat that the Russians would interfere with the 2018 election was tearing the country apart. He said that, you know, just so no matter who wins the 2018 election, if we're in a world in which we don't trust that it was fair, that can tear the country apart and pave the way for authoritarianism. So when somebody who's on the right, like David Gergen, is openly on cable TV worrying about authoritarianism, I think that we're in real danger. I've found the thing from Hannah Arendt, if you're still interested in having me read that, because it does a nice job of comparing left and right, as you were just talking about. She writes, "The ideal subject of totalitarian rule is not the convinced Nazi or the convinced communist, but people for whom the distinction between fact and fiction, true and false, no longer exist." So there it is.
That's excellent.
Yeah, left and right. You know, left and right. You can, you know, the Nazi or the communist, if they're a totalitarian government, what they want to do is erase the distinction between true and false, because that's what allows the authoritarianism to go on. I'll read you another quotation that I found here in the same file. This is from an article by E.J. Dionne, the great columnist for the Washington Post. He writes, those who challenge the portrayals of Trump as an authoritarian or an autocrat because our freedoms are still intact miss the point. In enduring democracies such as ours, liberty is eroded slowly by politicians who undermine the norms and practices that protect it. So, I mean, there it is too, right?
Mm-hmm.
We're living in an era in which people might indulge in happy talk and say, well, things aren't too bad yet. It's not authoritarian yet. Look at the government of Russia. Look at the government of China. China just the other day voted, their parliament voted that there were no more term limits on their leader. Those two societies have the trappings of democracy. They have votes. They have, they have parliaments. You know, they have plausible deniability to be able to say, oh yes, we're a democracy, but they're not a democracy. And what I fear is the day when the United States has the trappings of democracy, but we're no longer a democracy. I'm remembering here this is sort of dark, but I'll go with it anyway. Stalin once said, it matters not who votes. It matters very much who counts the votes.
Yes.
You know, if we can't trust the results of our election, you know, if we have another election or two in which we haven't done enough to fight back against Russian hacking, and say Trump wins in 2020, but there's a cloud hanging over it because people don't know whether the Russians interfered again. Might that tear our society apart? Might it result in martial law? We're facing the threat of authoritarianism now when the economy is booming, and I won't say we're at peace because we're not, but you know, it's been relatively quiet in the sense that we could, you know, we could be involved in a war with North Korea or China, but we're not. I mean, imagine the threat to liberty, imagine the threat to democracy when things get worse in this country. And I mean, things are pretty bad right now. I'm not saying that they're not, but I'm just saying that when a crisis hits, when the stock market crashes, when bombs start to drop, that's when one worries that the might be too late. Post-truth, at that point, truth is a very valuable thing, and if we can't rely on it, and somebody makes an authoritarian grab for power, I think we're in trouble. I didn't say very much about that in my book in Post-Truth, but as the months have gone by and I've started to read other people's work on this, I've really grown convinced that the most important thing about Post-Truth is not just where it came from, science denial, postmodernism, cognitive bias, but where it might be leading, which is, I'm afraid, authoritarianism.
Do you think there's no going back, basically?
I think there might be. I mean, if you look at there have been, the truth has been in trouble in human society many times. I think there's a way back, but it's painful. I mean, people have to. This goes back to the idea that it's not method, it's attitude. People have to care about truth. It has to matter to them, not just that they're on the right side, but that they have reason for thinking that the thing that they think is true. I mean, I'm somebody who also warns liberals, don't just think that post-truth exists only on the right. You know, examine your own beliefs, examine your own confirmation bias. Don't be satisfied to say, you know, oh, well, that sounds true, or that must be true, or where, you know, you want to believe it. Get the facts. I think of that recent book, Fire and Fury. I had a number of friends who read it as entertainment and, you know, would say, well, if even half of it's true, I believe it. Or, you know, that this is, this is so, or that just sounds like something that he would have said, even if they weren't sure. Now, I haven't really, you know, followed all the literature, how the story has gone.
since the book first came out. But I remember there being some questions raised when the book was first published over whether everything in the book was absolutely accurate, and you know, everything that was a quotation was double sourced, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm not saying it wasn't, because I don't know that. I haven't studied that. But the upsetting thing to me was that a number of my friends were willing to believe it, whether it was true or not. And I'm talking about people on the left. I'm talking about people who had such a hatred for Donald Trump that they were willing to believe the worst about him, even if what was written about him was not true. I think that's a danger. I think that you know, historically, if you look back in Galileo's time, the people on the left were the ones that were in favor of science and reason. I get very uncomfortable when people give up on the idea that truth matters, or that warrant matters, or that evidence matters, no matter what their political stripe, because I think that that's a danger. You see that in the science debates. There's some science denial from the left as well as the right. I think it's a danger now with post-truth.
One of the subjects that come up a lot on the podcast is technology and its impact on human evolution. Now, I want to ask you, as a philosopher, one of the questions that I always wonder, especially now that advancement in artificial intelligence is, you know, becoming quicker and quicker. And the question is about objectivity of ethics and morality, since our values and objectives and goals seems to be coming from our ethics and morality. Is ethics and morality objective to begin with?
That's a really tough question. There was a whole movement in philosophy around about the beginning of the 20th century where they thought that ethics could be a science, ethical theories were like scientific theories. And I'm not just talking about ethical behavior, but actual ethical theories. So I'm not quite sure how to answer that. I mean, that's, I guess people still have a certain debate over that, but I want to bring in the technology angle, because you started off the question, you said something about technology, and I'm not sure I quite understood the relationship that you were drawing between the technology and the question about morality. So can you say a little bit more?
With development of artificial intelligence, there are a lot of concern that artificial intelligence objectives would be different than ours. And one of the solutions that is being proposed is to create a more human artificial intelligence that operate according to our ethics, moralities, and values. So I've always wondered, if ethics and morality is not objective for humans, how can we quantify that and make it into a machine ethics and morality and value system?
You've asked a terrific question that I have absolutely no credentials to speak on at all. I really have not studied that question, and I just have nothing intelligent to say on it. I mean, technology does raise ethical issues. The technology surrounding the ability now on Facebook, on all social media, to direct our information flow based on what we've previously enjoyed looking at, what we've clicked on. So we're not even changing the channel anymore. Some technology company is changing the channel for us. So that's a technological issue that raises a moral question, I think. I was reading the other day about the robots. Does it matter how we treat robots? You know, if robots are not human, should there be an ethics? Should there be a morals for ethical code for how we treat robots, or does it just not matter, even if they look human, even if they act human? But the question you ask about AI, it's a fascinating question, and I'm sure you've got other folks that you'll have a podcast with who will say intelligent things about that, but that's just not down my street.
Yeah, fair. I've been talking to Lee McIntyre. He has a new book out, Post-Truth, that came out on February 9th and published by MIT Press. It's available on all digital and physical bookstores, I would imagine, too.
all over the country and on Amazon and all the other Barnes and Noble and all the other spots where people might buy books.
Excellent, excellent. So what's next for you, and what would be the best way for people who are interested to follow your work?
So my website is leemcintyrebooks.com, and that's always got the most up-to-date thing about what I'm working on next. My immediate work right now is I'm going on the road to give some talks about the book. Next for me, next week, I'm going down to University of West Georgia, which is in a very red state area. It's almost in Alabama. And I'm going to talk about post-truth, because one of my ideas is that, based on the research that I did in psychology, that one way to convince people who don't want to be convinced is to engage them in dialogue, to just keep telling them the truth over and over in a a careful way, not in a confrontational way. And so one thing that I've worried about is I live here, I'm in Boston, and I deal with a lot of other academics and folks, and I don't just want to live in a silo. I don't just want to live in a world in which I'm only talking to other people who already agree with me. I want to, if my views are right, I want to challenge them by seeing if it's actually possible to convince people who disagree with me. Again, the work that makes me think that I can do this is by people like David Redlawsk and James Kuklinski and other psychologists who have done studies on how one changes other people's belief. That's what I'm headed next. Doing that, I've got a talk in University of Nebraska in the fall, Amherst College. I'm doing a little bit more radio and such. After that, probably another book, but I'm not prepared to talk about that yet because I don't want to jinx it.
Well, I think the fact that you're getting engaged in conversation with other people, that's the most important thing. I'm a firm believer of open market of ideas, open market in all senses, but especially ideas, because when it begins by rejecting completely what the other side has to say, I mean, it's just creating enemies and winners and losers.
And it gets worse over time. I think that one of the fascinating questions in the post-truth story is how technology has enabled or disabled truth-telling over the ages. If you look back at the early journalism, the yellow journalism of the Hearst era, what happened when the Associated Press got started, the Telegraph, even back to the printing press, these were all technological innovations that had a big effect on how people consumed their news and on what they believed and what they didn't believe, what they thought was true and what they thought was false. Social media is our most recent one, and social media just exacerbates some built-in pre-wired cognitive biases that we have. I've already talked about confirmation bias, motivated reasoning. But, I mean, there are all sorts of ways in which the human mind is not perfectly equipped to believe things that are true. And the problem is that some of the social media makes it worse, because we are able to just retreat into these silos. We are able to pick a tribe and believe things because that's what our tribe believes, and that's very dangerous. I think that if there's a solution to post-truth, it's going to come from dialogue. It's going to come from engaging people insofar as possible, so that we keep people from slipping from ignorance to willful ignorance to denial, because once somebody's in denial, then they're not listening anymore. Then they just don't want to hear anything that doesn't already agree with what they believe. I don't think that most people are like that. I think that the hardcore science deniers, there aren't that many of them. But when they're given a big trumpet by the media, then they can influence a bunch of others. I think the same thing's happening now with post-truth. That's why I'm pushing back. I want to push back on the idea that there's such a thing as alternative facts. I want to push back on the idea that of what it really means to say there's fake news. I want to engage people in dialogue to see if there's any progress that can be made before it's too late.
That's awesome. Well, we can talk for hours, but I don't want to take much of your time.
I've enjoyed it.
Yeah, thank you very much. Let me ask the last question that I ask all my guests, that if you come across an intelligent alien from a different civilization, what would you say the worst thing humanity has done, and what would you say our greatest achievement?
If I came across an intelligent alien from another planet, what would I say is the worst thing that humanity has done, and what's the best thing that humanity has done? I'm buying myself some time here.
Of course.
I guess I would say that the worst thing that we have done is genocide, and the best thing that we've done is science.